Trusted Voices is a Cognizant podcast series that aims to showcase the diversity of thoughts, backgrounds, and identity of our 350,000 associates all over the world.
Well, welcome to Trusted Voices. Our guest today is David Fearn. David, before we dive into our conversation, would you mind just briefly introducing yourself?
Yeah, no problem at all. So I'm David Fearn. I'm the Global Head of Generative AI here at Cognizant.
All right. Well, I'm going to actually pick up on that little thread there. You have a title that sounds very exciting and intriguing, Global Head of Generative AI. Maybe you can share a little bit about what that means, what it entails. What do you do every day? Give us a little window into what that role is.
Yeah, sure. So I suppose my job kind of, generative AI is a responsibility of the whole company, right? Being able to understand it, being able to articulate it, being able to sell it, being able to articulate its value proposition to our clients. But kind of my role and my team's role is really to really build that, you know, deep technical value proposition around, okay, this is what we want to deliver, but how do we actually do it? One of the things about generative AI is I think it has an incredibly low barrier to entry. You know, anyone who's used ChatGPT, for example, has seen within seconds you can get value out of it. But in an enterprise setting, that value is kind of limited at around 70% just out of the box. But to get to that kind of like 80, 90, 95, 98% value, you know, and accuracy, that's kind of really where my team and my expertise comes in. And we perform a lot of what we call research to operations functions, where we take kind of the research that's done in academia and by big tech firms and figure out how to operationalize it in the context of our clients' kind of solutions to drive that kind of enterprise value proposition.
That sounds like a very exciting job and really sort of at the cutting edge of what's happening with generative AI. And, you know, you and the team have been recognized for your work. You recently won AI Solution Provider of the Year at the AI Summit in London. So congratulations for that. And, you know, what does it mean to win something like that? You know, everybody's talking about generative AI right now. I have to imagine it's pretty impactful to be noted for your work in this field.
No, do you know what? It really was. And actually this one above and beyond some of the others, not that I mean to kind of like rank our awards, but I think one of the things about this was this wasn't a vendor-based award. It wasn't a, you know, pay-to-play award. This was a proper, you know, industry award. So we were the only GSI on the entire list. So there was no other GSI. So none of our competitors were there. Our competitors at that award were research organizations, were startups, were big, you know, ISVs who their entire organization is dedicated to doing a generative AI of some description, or their entire research program is dedicated to something in Gen AI. And that's who we were competing with. And that's kind of why it meant a lot to win it, because it really was a recognition of the fact that we really are at the bleeding edge. We really are doing things that are new to world that, you know, I hope transfer beautifully into our clients' kind of consciousness is to realize that we have a very mature point of view when it comes to generative AI.
Can you give a brief, layman terms, you know, description of the award and the solution for which you won it?
Yeah, sure. So the award is the AI Conics, which is the AI Summit's like awards. And the award specifically was Solution of the Year. In the generative AI space. There was only three awards at the whole event, by the way. So once again, another kind of accolade that there wasn't like there was 25 different awards and we won some microcosm of the event. You know, we won one third of the awards, I like to think. So the solution itself is our AI clinician. This was a prototype that we actually developed for the Middle East to essentially bring equitable access to healthcare to everyone in that region, to like a population scale solution. So, you know, they have the problem statement is that they have kind of, it's a bit of a lottery as to when, you know, being able to get in to high quality healthcare. Their second and third, you know, healthcare systems are incredibly good, but it's that primary healthcare which is quite hit and miss. You know, if you're poor, you've got poor primary healthcare. If you're rich, you've got rich primary healthcare. There's very little in the middle. in the Middle East. So essentially, what we look to do is try and build an equitable, consistent front end to a kind of triage and kind of not replace primary healthcare, but be able to kind of fast track that triaging process to get you to the next place you need to be quicker. I think what's really important though, this was the technical solution was one part of it, but we are also breaking ground on actually how do you build systems that need high degrees of regulation in the Gen AI space. So actually we were writing and working with the kingdoms, and we've since been working with the Singapore government. I was in the UK Parliament last year presenting our research on the regulatory approach, the regulatory framework that we took to actually kind of, because we were developing this tech solution and we were developing the regulatory framework and the kind of principles that would go in place to actually provide it, to put it through some sort of medical device scrutiny, like your FDA do, like our medical regulator in the UK. So it was kind of a dual project, which made it even more challenging, but also even more rewarding.
So I think you sort of touched upon why you chose this clinical aspect, because in the Middle East, it sounds like there's, a shortage or an inability to necessarily get to the clinician that you need. How did you come up with the solution? What is the team like that thinks about this? And, what are the disciplines that you bring together to come up with a solution like this in the healthcare space?
So it's a really good question. So, I mean, the solution itself was relatively, that was probably the easiest piece of the whole thing, simply because, we were able to mimic a human service that we have in the UK called 111, which is our non-emergency service. So if you can't get to a doctor, if you can't get to a GP, you can phone up this phone line and there's human beings that sit there and go through an if this, then that style kind of matrix to get from your diag or what you're saying on the phone to the next best action. But it's very limited because it's essentially guided. If you go outside of the guardrails of this service, then they have nowhere to go. They have no kind of autonomy, no agency to be able to kind of actually do anything outside of maybe two or three outcomes. What we essentially said, this is our base. And what we want to do is basically expand this to have a much more high fidelity, creative and engaging conversation to be able to articulate the diagnosis or be able to eke out the symptoms much more accurately and be able to essentially triage many, many more conditions. So our system is actually capable of 918 different conditions with a 98% accuracy. We do that because we had training, we had essentially underlying kind of evaluation data that allowed us to test for 918 conditions. So we kind of limited the system's scope. But as you'd imagine, if you start to fall outside of 918 conditions, we have a catch-all, which is, go and see your primary physician after all, because you're going to need some kind of extra diagnosis because we're not really sure what's wrong with you. But what I think is more interesting than that is actually the way that we develop the solution. So I always say, one of the things about generative AI is it's probably 20% technical and then it's 80% linguistics. And I often use this, there's a few different analogies I use, but the primary one is, one of the big misconceptions that people have about Gen AI is that you can use a data scientist to kind of really get the most out of it. Data scientists are amazing when we're talking about math-based problems like machine learning, like traditional AI, like algorithms. But when we come into the Gen AI space, yes, it is underpinned on an algorithm, a bit like Word is underpinned on code, but no one writes code in Word. They write essays and kind of documents. And it's the same with Gen AI. The way that you actually get Gen AI to sing and really, really kind of like be accurate and be good is by instructing it with these linguistic techniques. So, where we have data scientists in the traditional machine learning and AI space, in Gen AI, we have information scientists. So that was kind of the really big change of pace from what we'd done previously. And the big learning was, actually, these linguists were what we needed to kind of be able to articulate the correct instructions, the correct definitions of what these LLMs should do, how they should behave, how they should interpret the conversation that we'd had between the AI had between the user and the patient, or the patient and itself, and essentially then interpret that and then make these diagnoses. So that linguistic programming, which is this brand new skill, this information science skill, was kind of one of our biggest learnings. And that was kind of what we then built the team around.
That is so terrific. Thank you for sharing that. So I'm going to shift gears just slightly and ask you to play futurist here. So talk to us a little bit about how do you think Gen AI is going to impact healthcare short term, say 5 years, and then longer term, about 20 years or so. Where do you think we're headed?
So first and foremost, I'm a real techno-optimist. You know, some might even call me an accelerationist. But my timelines, well, it depends who I'm talking to. I can generally tell pretty quickly if I'm talking to a conservative client or if I'm talking to a very, you know, a really forward-leaning client. If we're talking to a forward-leaning client, then I'm honest and I say, I'll be honest on this because hopefully everyone can get some value out of it. Those timelines of like 10, 20 years, they are way too far out. 10, 20 years, I can't even predict what we're going to have in 10 years. In the next, in my opinion, 3 to 5 years, we're going to have, and this goes for healthcare, but also for every major organization, company, organization, government, we're going to start to embrace, and we already do if you start to think about it, but we're going to start to embrace this hybrid work dynamic. And what I mean by hybrid work is not work from home, work from the office. I mean synthetic human workforces, where we have this synthetic workforce, which is our AI-based workforce, and we have our human-based workforce. And essentially, the two we will learn to essentially, you know, interact symbiotically with each other to be infinitely more productive. Yeah, this shouldn't be a scary thing. Saying synthetic workforce doesn't mean that we're going to have like AI or robots walking around the office. It basically means that, for example, I used to spend a lot of my time doing research, and then I developed two research AI research assistants that I use pretty much every single day. They are now part of my synthetic workforce. So essentially, I have these two agents that proactively work with me to essentially go off and do internet-based research, synthesize information, bring that back, present it, you know, and then, you know, turn it into knowledge and insights that I can use to drive outcomes. So that's we're already kind of there doing it now. We just don't really think about it. But the explosion of this synthetic workforce, you know, this researcher, do we need a translator? Do we need a this, that, and the other? That's only going to get more and more prolific as AI's capability becomes more and more trusted, more and more robust, I think is probably the big term, right? And actually, you know, that's probably where I see it going in healthcare, in finance, in education, is this driver. And just the last thing, but you know, a lot of people, the next question they ask me is, but why? Why should I care about that? Why do I need a synthetic workforce? And I said, well, AI will do one of three things for you. It's either going to be massively deflationary. So it's going to help you as a company to build a workforce that allows you to deliver your product or service at a fraction of the cost that you do today. And that's going to be your competitive edge. Or you're going to choose to deliver your product or service much quicker. And that's going to be your competitive edge. So I can do it for half the price or I can do it for half the time. What is the most, what's the most important to your clients? But the third thing, and I think this is probably the real thing that no one's thinking about right now, is it's going to help you to diversify your business. How many, I bet every single one of our listeners and every single, and I bet the two of you as well, have probably had a conversation at some point where you've gone, wouldn't we like to be able to do X? And everyone around the table has gone, that's a great idea, but we don't have the people, we don't have the this, we don't have the that, we don't have the other. Well, guess what? If you had a synthetic workforce, you could just literally click a button and replicate a whole load more workers to be able to help you to kind of underpin the legal, the research, the writing of things, the controlling of things, the managing of inboxes, all of these things that kind of slow us down from this diversification, this going into new markets, going into new regions, researching new products. So for me, it's all about the future is going to be the embracing of this synthetic human workforce to drive one of those three outcomes.
I love that. It's actually so optimistic and so good to hear. I think when people hear artificial intelligence, they just get terrified, like you're taking my brain away. But when you hear synthetic intelligence, okay, it's synthetic. It's not real, so as to speak. So it sounds a little less scary. So I love that you use that word. I think this is incredible. Now, you mentioned you've been talking to so many clients about all of this. What are they asking for in terms of Gen AI? Like, where do they think they could use this?
So I think that's one of the biggest things at the moment is we have this death by 1,000 use cases. you know, our clients, the honest truth is, I don't think our clients really know. But the ones who are super forward thinking, of which we have quite a few, they're experimenting, right? They're seeing a dual objective projects where the objective of the project is to, yes, deliver some value, but the value is measured in the value of the thing, but also in the value that the business gains from actually doing the project in the first place. And, you know, the intrinsic outcome that that can drive as a learning experience to help you to then refine your thinking, refine your use cases, refine your process to achieve it over time. And that's kind of one of the big outcomes that we look at. Just on your point that you made a second ago as well about, you know, the fear factor, you know, it's really interesting that you say that, because this is probably still one of, even what are we now, like, since the real kind of the real term of ChatGPT became real was kind of January last year. So what are we kind of like 18, 19, 24 months in? I still almost every single week find a challenge from a client about some of the fundamental kind of misconceptions of AI. And that narrative is largely driven by the media, by, you know, people who want to have this doomer, this nihilist kind of outcome. Whereas, you know, honestly, I think done it right or doing it right. And by the way, one of the real limitations of the human condition is our inability to see over the next horizon. And this is such a common issue, because that ability to see over the horizon, you know, we saw it when tractors were introduced in fields. We saw it when the Industrial Revolution, we saw it in the internet. Believe it or not, you know, a lot of people forget about this, but when computers were introduced to offices, everyone was like, oh, all those people who write stuff down on paper are going to be out of a job. No, we just found new jobs and we worked more productively and we found, and that's all AI is going to do. It's going to drive infinitely more productivity. Generally, when the world becomes more productive, when we take a step change in productivity, that's generally net positive for the world, for people, for well-being, for health. So, you know, as I say, techno-optimist, accelerationist, call it what you will, but I have a very positive outlook on what AI as a whole, Gen AI specifically, because I just think it's going to consume everything over time, will have on us as a world.
Yeah, no, this is so inspiring. And I use a silly little example, like, you know, photography didn't replace painters. People get very terrified.
We all gain more respect for analog. Everyone's like, oh, you know, AI could write. And in fact, there's an entire set of genres now on Kindle. There's a type of subscription on Kindle where you can get Kindle Unlimited. And people have started using AI to write books on Kindle Unlimited. And they're making half decent money out of it. And people are saying, well, is that going to kill authors? I know, because people will still want to know it's been written by a human being. To your point, a robot could paint something, but it's not going to mean anything. Whereas if a human's painted it, it is. And this is the thing, we will respect that human condition more. We'll have more time. It will mean more to us. The analog, you know, my wife has a Kindle. She's an English scholar. She still buys more books than I know what to do with. Because she loves the paper. And despite the fact it fills out my bag when we go on holiday, I love that she loves books. I love that she loves paper, because even though I am who I am, I still entirely get that is a really, you know, it's a really nice thing, a nice quality to have as a human being. And I just see us respecting that more and having, hopefully making more time for those kind of pursuits.
I love it. So refreshing. So that brings me to my last question. What are some of your favorite pursuits outside of AI and your work at Cognizant? What do you like to do for fun to unwind?
So I'm a big cyclist. I love my cycling. I love my cycling because I love the data that comes off of it. Data scientist at heart, you know, I've got more data than like anything else on my bike. But do you know what? Honestly, I'm, as you can probably tell, I'm super passionate about this topic. And I love, you know, reading, listening, watching. I love that there's these like new mediums for kind of learning. So, you know, I listen to probably 20 hours of podcasts a week on all different topics around AI and the IT industry. It's really sad because literally I'm just saying my job is my hobby, but it's kind of weird. And I think, you know, one of the things I love is, you know, the old adage of, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. Yeah. Don't tell my boss that. But, you know, it certainly is. So, you know, I get out and do my cycling, a little bit of the gym, But predominantly, yeah, I just really love what I do. I love learning about it. I love kind of talking about it, as you can probably tell. And yeah, that's kind of me. Thank you for asking. Very few
Terrific.
people do.
So thank you, David, so much for being with us today. It's Cognizant really is, sitting at the forefront of what's happening in generative AI, and clearly the work that you are doing is a huge part of our ability to kind of stay on that leading edge. So thank you for sharing a window into your world. It sounds very exciting, and we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you.